It's now my great pleasure to introduce Mr. James Daschuk. Jim Daschuk is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Kinesiology and Health Studies at the University of Regina and a researcher in the Saskatchewan Population Health and Evaluation Research Unit. His research focus is on the impact of environmental change on health of Indigenous people. Professor Daschuk's historical work investigates the role of disease, changes to subsistence practice, and climate change in the historical development of Western Canada. Current research projects include the impact of introduced species, horses, domestic cattle, on the well-being of First Nations people. Professor Daschuk.
Before I get started, I have a message from my 86-year-old French-Canadian mother. She thanks you all very much for getting me into church. It's been a while. Yeah. Now, I'm just waiting for this. I guess, as we're going, okay. So, yeah, so the computer is going. Helen said I have between 20 and 25 minutes, so if I'm speaking for too long, just give me the signal. So what I'd like to do today is I'd like to share some of the research I've been doing for the last little while, and probably the last 20 years or so. This is, I guess, the origins of this talk go back, two decades to the beginnings of my PhD thesis. And I had the good fortune to work for Dr. Q Young at the University of Manitoba Medical School. He's probably the preeminent epidemiologist of Indigenous people in Canada. And he was very interested in the origins of all the problems that he was dealing with. Like, they had to come from somewhere. So what I did was, I basically, as a research assistant, continuing on in my PhD, and even as a faculty member in kinesiology and health studies, have been looking at how we've gotten in to this really absurd situation. And let's see if I can get this thing going here. Great. Oh, there we go. Okay. So I work with SPHERU, the Saskatchewan Population Health Evaluation Research Unit. That's a mouthful. What we're interested in is we're interested in the population health of Saskatchewan and the rest of Canada. So rather than we as individuals, as patients, I guess, going to a physician or to a nurse, we're interested in how larger communities are doing, how well they're doing, and sadly, how badly they're doing. And I guess the concept that informs this is health inequity. So, we're even from the time we're born, we're not actually all born equally. Some of us have better facilities, some of us have better social economic conditions, that kind of thing. So when I talk about health inequity, it's divergences in health, usually between rich and poor people, but there are other factors. And there are things that we can do to change that. We're not all going to have the same, the length of our lives is not always going to be the same. Things are going to be different. But there are a whole bunch of issues that we as a society could change. And I guess I'll be talking about a few of those. Just where we are right now, you guys are a very well-informed community. You're probably aware that every year there's an annual report by the United Nations called the Human Development Index. And what that is sort of a statistical account of how well or how poorly nations are doing. It's life expectancy, quality of life, access to education, housing, quality of food, that kind of thing. And interestingly, somebody just mentioned Stephen Harper. Up until this past year, Canada was always in the top 10 of the 200 or so countries. This year, last year, 2013, was the first year Canada did not make the top 10. Normally, we're in the top 5, and it's Norwegians. Okay, so this is something to think about. But almost as a regular thing, when this comes out on the CBC News, everyone's very proud that we're normally in the top 10 of this Human Development Index. Almost invariably, there's a news story right after that reports on the same indices being applied to First Nations and Métis people in Canada. And by those accounts, our Human Development Index standards are very, very low. So we rival, I don't know if I've got this down here, we rival countries like Belarus and Jamaica, like the first life expectancy, education, that kind of thing. So we're living in almost two different worlds. And You know, these are our neighbors. It's not necessarily isolated communities, you know, 700 or 800 kilometers north of Regina. These are people in Regina, like within our city limits. So I don't have a lot of time to talk about this. I'm more than happy to talk at length about any of these slides later, if you like. Like I said, how do we get to this crazy situation? First Nations and Métis people can expect to live, in some cases, almost a decade shorter. They almost invariably have poorer health outcomes, higher incarceration rates, and I guess we'll talk about that. That's one of my last slides. There's a 20 to 30% gap between provincial funding. I know there's some retired education faculty, okay? These days, the average provincially funded student, I think, gets about $10,000 per child in the provincial education system. On-reserve funding is probably something more like $6,000. So that gap, if you multiply that by 200 or 300 children, is a huge amount of money. They can't afford to keep their schools going. In often cases, schools make the children sick because they just can't afford to maintain them. So instead of investing in schools, what the federal government is doing is building new prisons for people who fall out of that education system. It's kind of a little backwards, if you ask me. I've just got a few cut-and-paste slides from CBC News. We'll be hearing from this gentleman probably in a few months, James Anaya. He was brought in by the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Indigenous issues. He's been traveling, actually, all around the world. So there'll be whenever his report is done, there'll be a big media blitz, and also the federal government will probably deny that anything is a real serious issue. I'd just like to bring you back, sort of where we got to this crazy situation. This is something that a lot of us haven't really heard about. 1,000 years ago, okay, indigenous societies, especially in the woodlands of eastern North America, were so highly organized that some anthropologists have argued that they were at the state level. That they've argued that eastern North America was almost a country in the way we understand a country. This is the metropolis and capital of that culture, a city called Cahokia, and it's at the confluence of the Mississippi and Missouri rivers. It's right across the river from St. Louis, Missouri. And actually, at the top of that mound, you can see the Gateway Arch. Okay? That city was so big and so sophisticated, it was only surpassed by Philadelphia in 1800 with regard to population. So I told my students, anything you hear about from the American Revolution, this city was bigger. Okay, and potentially more sophisticated in a lot of ways, but like I said, it wasn't a pristine paradise, disease-free paradise. There was, for example, okay, to build that earthen mound, that pyramid that was larger than the pyramids at Giza, okay, some people probably had to be coerced to work, and there weren't animals to carry, to carry those earthen mounds. That was built with human labor baskets. And their shovels were probably the scapula of deer, okay? So it was a very highly organized society, probably wasn't an egalitarian society. Okay? So I don't want to, sort of paint this as a nirvana or anything like that. Sometime probably in the century before Columbus arrived, tripped over the Bahamas and unleashed a whole flurry of activity that led to us today, there was a huge change in global climate, okay? That's what the red part of the line, that little, my poor medieval warm period and the little ice age, there was across the Northern Hemisphere, there was a downturn in climate, okay? In England, okay, you guys remember the Doomsday Book when the Normans took over? Okay, they did a census, and the drink of choice in England in the 10th and 11th century was wine. 200 years later, 300 years later, okay, vineyards disappeared and beer overtook it. Okay, that's what gets my students. They're kind of interested in that kind of thing. Okay, and what we have is Cahokia itself, that huge metropolis, broke down even before Europeans showed up. So it wasn't the fault of our ancestors. They just didn't adapt well to climate change. Things weren't perfect. You can see in that bottom left-hand corner, that's a bone bed, the remains of 500 people who were killed, had their village burned on top of them, and then a new village was built on top of that by a different ethnic group. It was just a sign of how much displacement there was, how much violence, how much chaos, really, even before a European showed up. So again, things weren't perfect. Okay, and this is something that I got from University of Florida Press. This is an example of there have been probably 250 or 300 skeletons uncovered by archaeologists with evidence of tuberculosis, okay? Just because it leaves lesions on bones and they, you know, remain. So what's interesting is that most of the tuberculosis, and TB is a disease of, it's a very reluctant disease. One-third of humanity, even in the 21st century, is TB positive. One-third of humanity isn't sick with it, though. You almost have to be immune-suppressed, you have to be hungry. HIV, if you're infected with HIV/AIDS, something like that, will cause TB to break out and show clinical symptoms. You can see that that huge spike is right around when this climate deteriorated. So there's some kind of relationship. It's not really a scientific relationship. It's just to show you guys that something was going on. Now, and I apologize for the gory slide on a Sunday morning. That's my way. This is sort of a catalog of introduced diseases that came, you know, as a biological consequence of Europeans showing up and basically the unification of the New World with the Old World. So you can see smallpox was far and away the most significant killer. But there was actually a whole, you know, sort of list of introduced diseases that First Nations people, for a whole bunch of ecological reasons, had not been exposed to. Okay. That being said, for 150 years, smallpox was probably the biggest killer, the biggest threat to First Nations and Métis people. Okay, it swept through in probably every generation. There was a new wave of smallpox introduced up until the 19th century, introduced from ships from Europe because it was endemic in Europe and the population in North America wasn't really big enough to sustain smallpox. Okay? So that being said, there was a huge loss of life. Some people have said that those introduced diseases, and they weren't introduced on purpose, they were just, these were germs that were carried along, you know, by people who didn't understand the germ theory of disease, that there could have been as much as 80% of the indigenous population of America may have died in those early epidemics. People are still arguing about this. It's been 50 years that people are still kind of working on this. That being said, the folks who lived here, the indigenous communities that lived here and subsisted on the bison, were some of the best fed people in the world. In fact, there were some American physical anthropologists that have been writing about this, and they actually had an article called "The Tallest in the World, Native Americans in the Great Plains in the 19th Century." So the quality of their nutrition, bison is very high protein, quite low fat, okay? So if it weren't for those generational epidemics, it would have been one of the healthiest populations in the world. So that's kind of our backdrop. Okay? And I want to take you guys way back to 1876 to the negotiations at Fort Carlton. I encourage everybody to go take a trip up just past Waukaw to go check out Fort Carlton. It's a beautiful rebuilt historic site. Okay? And one thing about the negotiations at Fort Carlton in 1876... it was only a couple months after Custer and his cavalry unit lost their lives at the famous Battle of the Little Bighorn. Okay? So everyone at Fort Carlton was on their best behavior and not looking for a fight, but kind of ready for whatever might come. So, for example, the Mounties, they rounded up as many Northwest Mounted Police as they could as a show of force, just, you know, like, we're here, this is the Canadian presence. But also the Plains Cree, who were the main negotiators at Treaty 6, were there in force as well. So nobody wanted trouble, but everyone meant business at those negotiations. And Treaty 6 was the most highly negotiated of the numbered treaties, okay? Like, they negotiated for 3 days about what was in there. And some of the new provisions, and like I said, Treaty 6 was an innovative treaty. They negotiated for extra assistance in agriculture. So the Plains Cree knew that the bison wouldn't be around forever and that it was time to shift over to agriculture. That was the new paradigm. Also, something that potentially lawyers and government officials have been sort of debating and arguing over for the last 120 years is something called a medicine chest clause. The last big epidemic of smallpox went through only 6 years before this, 3,600 people. Nitsitapi Blackfoot people and Cree people on the North Saskatchewan died in a smallpox epidemic in 1870. So the negotiators knew the value of Western medicine. The value of Western medicine in 1870 was probably a mason jar with smallpox scabs in it, okay? But even with that simple technology, you could scratch someone, stick a smallpox scab, and they were inoculated, okay? It was a not a precise technique, but it worked. Okay. The one new stipulation of Treaty 6 that is relevant, I guess, to this talk is a guarantee of assistance in time of famine or pestilence. Lesser known famine and pestilence clause. And like I said, these are negotiated nation to nation. So the Plains Cree who were at Fort Carlton were free. They weren't under duress. They were in good shape. Okay. Things are about to change though, sadly. Okay. There was some concern over food, though. Chief Beardy, you guys have heard of Beardy's Okamasis First Nation, okay? And this is what Alexander Morse, the Treaty Commissioner, wrote in his diary. So Chief Beardy asked, in a time of national famine, okay, not what happens in everyday life, like we don't want food every day, but if there's a famine, we want your commitment that you'll help us, okay? And I guess the metaphor, we don't want to die like dogs. And Commissioner Morse, we won't let you die like dogs. Promise. Okay? So that's, this is in the negotiations. And this is the famine and pestilence clause. So I won't make you read the paragraph. But in a general famine, the government will grant character, blah, 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 and necessary and sufficient to relieve the Indians of calamity that shall befall them. So there is some kind of commitment that the government will help. Well, sadly, within probably, 20 months of the signing of Treaty 6, for a number of factors, the bison disappeared on the plains. Like the northern Great Plains, southern Saskatchewan and Alberta were some of the best bison hunting country in the world, and the bison disappeared. So you can see, this is just evidence. These are all bison skulls. That mound is built up of bison skulls. Okay, and for a very few years after the construction of the railway, there was a small sort of cottage industry in people bringing bones of bison and shipping them back to Ontario to be rendered into things like soap and that. Okay, pile of bones that we all live in. I don't think I have almost overnight. And no one was really prepared for the disappearance of the bison. Okay, the Cree hadn't really foreseen it. And the Canadian government was a very minuscule presence. There really weren't any settlers per se. Maybe a couple hundred in Battleford, the first the first farming community that was set up, and then the Mounted Police. That was really it. Okay. There was a newspaper in Battleford, the Saskatchewan Herald, and I use that quite a bit for my research because he wrote a weekly blog, not a blog, he wrote a weekly column about what conditions were like. And probably not surprising, very racist, not very supportive of the Indigenous population. And here's an example of how tough things were, even in the fall. So this is only 4 or 5 months after the buffalo disappeared. This is a want ad for someone who found a horse in Battleford. So found where the Indians starved to death, a white horse. And if you found it, so if that's your horse, come and see me. So rather than Indigenous people, like rather than that being the news, it was the fact that there was a horse found where those people died. So it's a sign that it's normal. Or I don't know about normal, but banal, it's not really news. Okay. And I'm not an expert on Amartya Sen, Nobel laureate, but one of his things is, it's in a famine, and we'll be talking about a famine in the next few minutes. In a famine, it's not that there is absolutely not enough food. Okay, Sen got his Nobel Prize because he realized that in times of famine, it's the inability of people to procure the food. That's the important thing. So somewhere there's food, it's just the people who are hungry aren't getting the food. Okay. And within months, okay, so like I said, the Canadian presence in this part of the country, in the Northwest Territories, was tiny. A few hundred, there probably weren't 1,000 Europeans in the area at the time. But just south of the border, the ranching industry was established. There was actually quite a going concern at Fort Benton, Montana. And there was actually, in the context of this and the Northwest Mounted Police coming up, there was actually quite a big corporation that supplied all of the needs, basically, of the Northwest Mounted Police, and they were the almost the monopoly contractor for the Indian Department, I.G. Baker and Company. And what they did was, on a daily basis probably, they had bull trains like this going from Fort Benton to whatever police post, Fort Walsh especially, in the Cypress Hills. Okay, and those contracts were worth, even in 1870s dollars were worth millions of dollars because they were supplying the police with all of their needs, all of their food, all of their hardware, you name it. Okay? But the food wasn't necessarily getting to the people who are hungry. So the Niitsitapi are the people, formerly known or popularly known as the Blackfoot people in southern Alberta. So a whole bunch of those people walked from southern Alberta up to Battleford, and as the newspaper said, many of them were dying because they couldn't subsist on a diet of roots. So they're on a forced march several hundred kilometers from their homes to Battleford, where they were trying to get assistance. You can see here, this is in the newspaper, accustomed all their lives to diet of animal food. So, you know, even a year or two earlier, very high protein diet. And what they're getting is small rations of flour and tea. So they're in this sort of 19th century prose, but one removed from starvation. Okay. So, I'll be telling you about people who actually succumbed to starvation, like who starved literally to death. But from a health perspective, what's more important is that so many people were hungry for so long that their immune system was suppressed and tuberculosis broke out like wildfire in those communities. And they've never really caught up. You know, I was telling you guys about that sort of gap 120 years later. Okay, here's another one. Okay, this is from a published account in the Sessional Papers, the Indian Affairs Report. Okay, Touchwood Hills. So the Indian agent writes, well, the pork, okay, so this would be the bacon, cured meat, is musty and rusty, totally unfit for use. We're giving it out to the Indians, but we can't use it ourselves. Okay? And there's actually several instances where hungry populations were supplied with spoiled meat. And one Indian agent, for example, was praised for re-curing the bacon. The bacon had gone bad, and they re-smoked it. Okay? And there's an instance around Sintaluda where potentially 120 people died of poisoning from eating spoiled meat. But again, they're so hungry, they didn't really have a choice. There were questions about, how's this all going on? Because it was one monopoly contractor going on. And this is John A. Macdonald giving bags of money to a capitalist. You can tell he's a capitalist. He's got a top hat and a monocle and a cigar. Okay? And in the background, so this is a liberal paper called The Grip. So the liberals are complaining about this, but it really isn't a big widespread scandal in the East. No one really cared. They were working on the railroad. Okay? Another thing was that some rations were provided on people on the verge, but there was no contingency for clothing because while the buffalo were still around, bison supplied all the clothes. So with the buffalo being gone and people subsisting on flour and tea, people had no clothes. So actually there were several winters where people are almost naked and there were fights about who got the cotton sacks that were left over from rations and stuff. Quite terrible. Edgar Dewdney, as he was coming to take over basically the Northwest Territories, he was John A. Macdonald's trusted lieutenant here in the West. In his diary, he found 1,300 Blackfoot people in southern Alberta on the verge of starvation. Strong young men, now so weak, many could barely walk. So like I said, these are the tallest people in the world who are now potentially some of the most hungry. Okay. This is one I just put in just to sort of add it. John McCown was a Dominion botanist, okay? So he's a government scientist traveling through basically doing an assessment of the area, okay? And in his memoir, he recounts the story of paying some Blackfoot women to wash his dishes. And he's flabbergasted because, and this is a quote from his book, before they washed the plates, they licked them clean. He couldn't understand why. And then there's a Catholic priest who was in the settlement who berated McCown because he didn't realize, and this is the quote, so, don't you know these people are dying of starvation? There's two dead in the tent just over there that have died of starvation. So a lot of people just didn't understand what was going on, and especially the scientists were newcomers. They really didn't understand how bad things were. Okay? Now, as the famine broke out in the spring of 1878, Johnny Macdonald and the Conservative Party were re-elected. All of us have been through grade 6 history class, okay? The national policy, you guys remember that? So the quick construction of the railway, okay, and that would join British Columbia to the rest of Canada, okay? Well, so the preeminent policy decision on the part of the federal government was getting the railway built as quickly and as cheaply as possible. So within months of the famine breaking out, by 1879, it was decided that only Indian people, okay, so using the old term, only First Nations people who had signed treaty and taken up their reserves, and the reserves are out of the way of the railway, would be supplied with food. Okay? So in 1879, for example, we have three or four major chiefs essentially exchanging their freedom for food. And interestingly, all of those reserves are up around Battleford, 300 kilometers or more away from where the railway was eventually built. Okay? And this is a rationale, so you can see the people sort of looking in. Also, because the cattle industry was being established in northern Montana and in southern Alberta, southern Saskatchewan, there was, I think, 20 million cattle were driven north from Texas between the end of the Civil War and 1891. It was the largest human-led migration of animals in history. Okay, with that came new diseases, and one of them was basically sending Texas cattle into, you know, the Canadian winter. So thousands of cattle died, and what ended up happening was, you can see this one painting from a famous cowboy painter, Charlie Russell, in 1886. The sick ones ended up going to Indian reserves. The ones that were in good shape, of course, went to the Mounted Police, who were the prime customers. Okay, and you can see Fort Ellis in 1881, people starving to death on their rations. And really, the government wasn't very supportive of this. They did all they could to actually keep the cost down. So the conservative finance minister said, well, they have to work or they're going to starve to death. Nobody gets free food, even in time of a famine. Okay. Now, I guess this is a pretty salient one. So by 1882, the railway construction between Winnipeg and Regina was actually quite fast because there really isn't anything in the way. And by 1882, the construction is approaching the Cypress Hills and what eventually becomes Maple Creek. So in Parliament, and like I said, I've given this variations of this talk before. This isn't a conspiracy theory. This is from Hansard. So this is, you know, like on record. The Prime Minister said in March of 1882 that all of the Indians in the territory of Assiniboia, so that would be southwestern Saskatchewan, that sort of district, south of the proposed railway line, would be removed from the area by force if necessary. Okay, so a lot of people have asked me, this is ethnic cleansing. Like, the area will be emptied of Indigenous people in preparation, basically, for settlers, for the building of the railroad. Okay, and sadly, I guess, the Cypress Hills was the last sanctuary because those of you who've been to Cypress Hills, beautiful part of the province. And communities had access to fish, to deer, different kinds of game other than bison. So in the early 1880s, a lot of the chiefs were trying to find sanctuary in the Cypress Hills and had actually asked for reserves in the Cypress Hills where they could have been self-sufficient. Okay, government wouldn't accept this. And in fact, Fort Walsh, the main food supply area, provided by the Mounties, and the Mounties were actually the advocates of First Nations people for the first 10 years in their presence in the West. On government orders, they were forced to shut down Fort Walsh and move their detachment to Maple Creek on the railroad. Okay, so there's 5,000 people, and again, Saskatchewan Herald, in their own terminology, were marching toward the government grub pile in Battleford. Okay, and here's another quotable quote from Johnny MacDonald. Okay. We can't let the people die of starvation, okay? But we're doing everything we can to keep them on the very edge of starvation to save on costs, okay? So, and there's, you know, sort of correspondence between government officials. They knew that if thousands of people died of starvation on the prairie, that there would be a scandal in the East. So they couldn't deal with that. They didn't need the hassle. But what they did do was keep them malnourished for so long that they could basically control all of their movements. And it was very effective. Within probably a year or two of this policy being implemented, almost everybody was on reserve and under the control of Indian agents, and you name it. Okay, probably the most famous example of a chief trading freedom for food was that chief whose English name we know as Big Bear. Okay, And like I said, terrible conditions. And in December of 1882, basically he and his starving group came to the police post. Okay, where do I put my axe? And yeah. So one of the outcomes of this, I'll quit talking. I'm pretty sure I'm over time. You can see these little triangles. Okay, these are Indian Reserves, First Nations communities. Okay, you can see that in the territory from Regina all the way to the border. Okay, out of I think 78 First Nations in the province, there are only two in that area. Okay, the one on the far side, number 41, I see in the number by Maple Creek, is a Cree reserve that was originally led by a chief called Nikanit. Okay, they didn't get reserve status. What they did was Nikanit had a very small band, and he's like, let's just stay here. Let's just go fishing. Let's keep out of the way of the Europeans and try to survive. So they got reserve status in during the First World War. Okay? And even today, there's actually a women's correctional facility, but the community is quite small. It's only like 230 people or something like that. Okay, so that's Nikanit. And then there's a very small Dakota reserve, non-treaty reserve, at Wood Mountain. And that one, I don't even know if anyone actually lives on the reserve anymore. I think the band only has 50 people. That reserve was only granted in the 1920s or 30s. Okay, so you basically have all of that area without the triangles set up as prime land for our agrarian ancestors, those of us of European descent. So the plan, you know, sort of worked out from the governmental perspective. Just a couple more. This is a photo of Chief Crowfoot, okay? And my friend Bruce Walsh and I have been in contact with Don Smith, okay, from the University of Calgary. Crowfoot was one of the most high-profile of the Blackfoot chiefs, okay? He'd actually been to Johnny McDonald's house, okay? This is a family photo taken, I think, in 1884. Within 2 years of that photo taken, every single one of those children died of tuberculosis. Okay? And Crowfoot wasn't far behind. Crowfoot, I think, was dead by 1890 or so. Okay? Now, one interesting thing, okay, and I apologize for the funny-looking slide, okay? This wasn't just an organic process. Okay? As all of this crazy stuff is happening, the very few Dakota people, Dakota communities in Saskatchewan, okay, they were considered to be refugees from the United States. They didn't enter the treaties, okay, and there's some negotiation actually in 2013 about whether they should adhere to Treaty 4. Well, it was probably fortunate that they didn't adhere to treaties because as people were starving, these are people right next door. Standing Buffalo is right near Echo Lake Park near Fort Capel. I don't know if you guys have been there. It's quite beautiful, okay? The neighboring reserve, Pasqua, was undergoing all of the things I've just told you guys about. Famine, hardship, you know, violence, and whatever. These folks, Standing Buffalo, because they didn't have an Indian agent and because they weren't bound by the terms of treaty, by all the, you know, the free stuff that treaty provided them, they built the railroad from Regina to Prince Albert. So, and there's a physician that went through to vaccinate for smallpox. He's like, oh, I couldn't vaccinate any of the Dakota. They're all out working. Okay, this was almost an example of how things could have gone right because they didn't have, and even if you look at, say, I do a lot of work in the National Archives, there's probably 1/50th of the records from the Dakota reserves compared to the Cree and Soto reserves that were treaty. Okay, just quickly, okay, while TB, you know, was the main cause of death for First Nations people, it was also like the preeminent health issue to all of our ancestors. Okay. What we do have, though, very soon after is we have, after the famine, is we have institutionalized, basically institutionalized conditions that provided, you know, a constant fuel for tuberculosis. So this is actually a photo of a child. I've got a couple pictures of the Regina Indian Residential School. Just, I think it was just on Pinky Road, just on the border between the city of Regina and the RM of Sherwood, not too far from the global transportation hub. And so this is a before and after picture of a child. You guys have probably seen that. Okay, Duncan Campbell Scott was kind of the overseer of Indian affairs for probably 30 or 40 years. Okay, what was his goal? No more Indian problem, no more Indians. Okay, so one of his goals was assimilation, but he really, like, he was driven from the idea that this is a doomed race, so let's just get it done with. Okay, There were some people who fought for, you know, fought for improved conditions. Peter Henderson Bryce, for example. Okay, one of the first systematic observations of residential schools. So even in 1907, either between a fifth and a third of every student who'd ever been to a residential school in 1907 was already dead. Okay, so the numbers were absolutely horrendous. This is probably the worst, the File Hills Agricultural Colony, which was considered to be the gold standard of community development and agrarian development with regard to the Indian Affairs Department. This photo is actually the Governor General coming to File Hills and checking it out because, you know, they were showing it off. Okay, 75% of the students that had attended it in 16 years had already died. Okay, so like the numbers are actually hard to for me to wrap my head around. Okay, just another quick one here. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has hired a team of archaeologists and historians. 5,000 children, okay, there are burials of 5,000 children that they know about outside of residential schools. They estimate that another 3,000 have yet to be found because they were unmarked. And just this is part of our own community. This is from the Regina Industrial School, like I said, just outside of town. And there's actually a movement. Our mutual friend David McLennan is with a heritage group that's trying to have this graveyard, like I said, just on the edge of town in sort of an industrial area, at least marked as a heritage site. Okay, the owner is very respectful. He's not going to build a trucking plant on that site, but there's no recognition. And from what I hear, there's actually some resistance by town council to have a memorial to, you know, such a negative thing. You guys have probably heard about this. Okay, residential schools, in addition to being, I don't know, places of hardship, were actually places of experimentation from Government of Canada physicians. So physicians can't write prescriptions for food. And even in the 19th century, you know, physicians were like, these people need food, they don't need medicine. Physicians didn't have the ability to get more food to the people. And probably in the 20th century as well, they probably said, these kids need more food. People running the residential school, we don't have more food, we don't have the funding. So what they did was, they did experiments on those malnourished children by providing, this is as vitamin science is just really sort of developing. So it's like, well, what if we gave these malnourished children vitamin E supplements? What if we gave them another kind of supplement? So that was okay because they could probably bring those supplements in by themselves. But there's been quite a big controversy about that. And, you know, impose changes. I'll just go through this very quickly. Okay, this is a tuberculosis tent. This is the gold standard of tuberculosis treatment in the early 20th century. Kind of reminds me of a teepee. Okay. But, of course, people were taken off the land and forced into homes as part of the socialization process. Okay, and I guess, again, with that, with regard to the housing. This is a photo from Thunderchild Reserve. That car is probably like a late 1950s, 1960 car. So they're still living in, you know, dirt floor trapper's cabins almost. Okay, and again, that legacy continues on even to this photo. I cut and pasted this in November. Okay, Attawapiskat, which many of you folks have heard about, had such bad conditions, the chief asked the Red Cross for help. There was just a fire in November, and 90 people that have been living in a NACO trailer had the trailer burned down. So even their terrible living conditions, now they've been moved 300 or 400 kilometers to a motel. So now they're living in a motel outside of their community. Okay. And just a couple other facts. Okay, this was a report from the spring. Okay, in Saskatchewan, 64% of Stannis First Nations children live below the poverty line. And, you know, like I said, I'm interested in this gap. This gap has always existed. The green line is infant mortality rates among First Nations kids. And you can see how, you know, it's extremely high. In 1937, almost 1 in 3 children, infants, died in Saskatchewan. So we've got it going down almost to nowhere. But even today, infant mortality, I bet you, would be 5 times as high as it is in mainstream population. And those things can be dealt with. Okay. This is pretty near my last slide. Okay, so this was during the 2011 election. Okay, Sean Atleo, the chief of the Assembly of First Nations, wrote a column because really First Nations issues weren't on the table. Okay, average TB rates, 31 times higher in First Nations people than the national average. Infant mortality, 3 times as high. I was telling you guys about the gap in education. Okay, so a First Nations child has a greater chance of being incarcerated, of going to jail, than finishing high school. To me, that's insane. Okay. And I don't know if everyone remembers the North Battleford boil water issue from 10 years ago. Okay, the Canadian Tire parking lot was basically carpet bombed with Dasani water. In 2011, there were 114 communities that still had to boil their water. I've been talking for a long time. Something that's kind of come up, and I know Dr. Christensen has said that everyone here is very opinionated. Something I'd like to hear from you guys, and this is an issue that I wasn't really prepared for. I'm not sure if Bruce is really prepared for it, but we're coming up to the bicentennial of John A. MacDonald's birth, okay? And I personally do not hate John A. MacDonald, okay? I've just accounted, you know, his activities in one small, area of his endeavor. But there has been a whole lot, even in the last few weeks, and these are just cut and pasted from the last week. The Chinese community, and this sort of italics is a very racist statement from MacDonald about why Chinese people had to pay the head tax because they didn't have any vested interest in becoming Canadians or whatever. And then this is another one from Bernie Farber that was just in the paper. And I guess, I don't know if we have time during the service, but I'd like to hear from you guys. I'm not sure how to deal with this, to tell you the truth. Like, I don't hate John A. MacDonald. I don't want he built the country. But in one sense, he built the country that we live in today with blockades and all these conditions. So I'm sure I've spoken for too long, so I'll just stop right now. Thank you.